You're listening to PodTech.net. I'm Michael Johnson. At the Forrester Consumer Conference 2006 in Chicago, Forrester principal analyst Paul Jackson spoke on social computing and moving beyond the PC. More and more, users are accessing social network services like blogs, RSS feeds, online gaming and podcasting at places other than home and on mobile devices like cell phones and portable gaming consoles. In this talk, Jackson profiles some of these emerging technologies.
I'm going to do a session now which is a bit more forward-looking, where today's picture of social computing could go in the future. So it's beyond the PC, is my thesis here. Let's see if this works. So first of all, show of hands. Everybody's hand in the air. Don't worry, I'm European, so this isn't going to be very embarrassing. Everybody's hand in the air, please. I can wait. We all carry, if you're like me, a bunch of devices. Presumably most of you have traveled to Chicago from at least some distance to be at this event. So in your bags or on your person, you're carrying a number of devices. And I'm thinking here of anything that has a keypad or a screen or storage or a battery. Let's forget things like noise-canceling headphones or Bluetooth handsets. But I want you to put your hands down when we get to the number of devices that you haven't got. So if you're carrying three, when I get to four, put your hand down. So no devices. Who's not carrying any devices with them to this event? One device. Wow. I love people who always carry one device. I wish I could manage with one device. Two devices. Three devices. Still got somebody back there. Four devices. Yeah, that's kind of where I top out as well. Yeah, and they've all got separate chargers, and they've all got batteries, and they've all got different connection leads to PCs, typically. But what's interesting is that all of them, in general, are either reliant on the PC or the PC network. So even your BlackBerry, effectively, you're usually getting emails from people on other PCs. And what my thesis for today is, that's not necessarily the best way, particularly of doing social computing applications, to have that PC in the center of the network. So what I'm going to do is run through three sort of agenda items here in terms of this thesis, and get your feedback, ask questions as we go along. If they're really tricky, I'll ignore them till the end, and then hopefully we'll run out of time. And get your thoughts on some of these devices, some of which you'll have seen, some of which you won't have seen, some of which are in the market, some of which aren't, and see if you're agreeing with me in terms of my thinking here. So first of all, making the PC sexy again. I think one of the things that we're all seeing at this conference and at other conferences this year, and with the rise of Web 2.0, is that it's making the PC more attractive to use again. After years and years of people doing e-commerce and online banking and a bit of travel booking and research, Web 2.0 stuff, particularly for young consumers, as we saw in the previous presentation, is really what's turning them on, is really what's dragging them back to the PC, getting more internet access, and getting them to work with that PC for a number of hours every week, more hours than they've ever done before. So I like to think of it like this. Even in the internet age, the PC was all about productivity, saving time, saving effort, extra convenience, education, gaming, banking, e-commerce. Now, for that admittedly small minority of consumers that are doing these kind of social computing applications, you're seeing things like connectivity, communications, drawing people to that PC at various times, which they wouldn't have done otherwise. And you're seeing the PC manufacturers respond to that with a whole bunch of new PC forms, which have been long mooted, but are now actually making it into the market. Tablet PCs, UMPC devices, ultra-mobile PC devices, very small footprint devices, like the Mac Mini. And inevitably, whenever Apple designs a product, there are soon copies would be disingenuous, tributes to that kind of device. Devices which wouldn't look at home in the living room or in your car, wherever you're traveling. So the PC is adapting to this new sexiness, to the way that you can start using these applications on the go. But the problem is, it's still a PC. Most of the time, it will be tethered to a power socket, It will be in your home office. It'll be in the spare bedroom. It'll be in the kids' bedroom. And that restricts what you may want to do with that device. So let's quickly, I'm zipping through this because I want to get to these cool devices at the end. I'm a devices guy. That's what really gets me excited. So I want to get your take on these. Let's quickly look at what those kind of limitations are. And I'm going to do that by focusing in on one specific area of applications which has really come from nowhere over the last 12 months and is proving to be, if not a significant revenue generator, certainly something which is getting a lot of hype. YouTube, or more broadly, video services, video delivered over the internet, IPTV, or download services, anything that's basically using the internet as a carriage to deliver video, TV programming, films, etc. There's a slide that I've been using for a while now, sort of riffing on the whole long tail theory, thesis, which I presume you're all familiar with. It's been all over the business press for the last year or so. This is the video long tail, and you see that it applies just as well here. What we've traditionally had is the same as the bookstore for the long tail. So we've had the stuff up the left-hand side, Super Bowl, lost episodes, films. But we've had very little down this end, down the obscure end, you know, the fishing with dynamite side of things. But you can now see that there are sort of four clear divisions of video emerging. Of course, we're still going to have broadcast and cable, and they're still going to be watched by way, way, way more people than any other form of video. But you're starting to see that there are now viable services for movies and video on demand, which have been available in the market for years and years, sometimes via analog systems, but typically have been inconvenient or limited in scope or limited in catalog in terms of what they could offer. You're now also starting to see niche subscription channels, which are being delivered typically over IPTV, but also over some other types of delivery services, over an internet backbone. And this is where you start to see the Scotch Whisky channel, which opened up about 4 or 5 weeks ago, where you can subscribe to this channel, and it's all Scotch Whisky all the time. Drinking it, storing it, making it, cooking with it, I presume. There we go. I've got one potential subscriber already for this. Drinking it. Yeah, just stop there. There aren't enough people probably in the US to make that commercially viable. But globally, there probably are. And then you get down to the extreme niche stuff, the personal programming, videos you've made yourself, what YouTube actually hosts legitimately, the spoofs, the pratfalls. And a lot of that, but extremely low viewership in general. And you're also seeing a bunch of business models emerge around this. Down at the left-hand side, as you're looking at it, the business models are well established and are pretty much as they've always been. Subscription, advertising, in terms of rental, it's obviously buying, renting, downloading. And then advertising continues to this side, so Google hopes so. But you're also seeing things like IP, people being paid for the clips that they're uploaded and sharing that with other people, and ultimately advertising to a degree supporting that, or again, niche subscriptions. So video has really come a lot further than a lot of us, I certainly expected, in the last 12 months. Yes?
Shouldn't you just make the distinction that advertising is content as well as a revenue source?
True. Certainly my marketing colleagues would go for that and sort of say that, yeah, that this blends in. It might even be your own vertical here, somewhere between broadcast and movies. It's a sliver which is ad content or commercially sponsored content. I certainly agree with that. But luckily for my argument, this is really just a point to illustrate, you know, where does video work well? Three major device categories, which we track obviously in some detail at Forrester and across multiple markets. Obviously, I cover more closely the European market than the US market, but have certain global coverage areas. And video works on each of these platforms. On the mobile phone, you obviously got a limited display, probably a limited battery life, limited sound, but it's great for short content, relatively low quality content, very timely content, and typically today you're looking at free content, although there are subscription services in North America and Europe which are pushing out TV contenting over the mobile network, but are really only talking to a very small audience and haven't quite got the business model right yet. For the PC, again, it's all about infinite choice. You know, this is the device by default that's connected to the internet. You can get short or long format content. It could be movies, could be low quality, could be high quality. The vast majority of it, particularly outside of America, is free. In other words, consumers haven't paid for it. They've acquired it via some other source, typically via peer-to-peer networks, ripping DVDs, things like that. But the biggest problem is TV, as it is manufactured today, long-form TV, is best suited to the final display mechanism, TV, by definition, where you've got the best experience. It's a shared experience with your family or your friends. It's an experience which, you know, you've been familiar with for 40 or 50 years. It's also a user interface which is more or less intuitive. It's getting less so if you start having four components and two set-top boxes and home networking. But typically, I could walk into any house anywhere around the world and work out how to use the TV. In Japan, I have trouble working out how to use the toilet, but I could work out how to use their TVs. The problem is today that the vast majority of video-based social computing is ending up on those devices. Happy slapping is a brilliant UK phenomenon, I hope it's just the UK, whereby school kids take videos on phones. Whoops, shouldn't have done that. Take videos on their phones of them slapping somebody in the school ground, highly amusing, and then upload it. There have been questions asked in Parliament about this and how they can clamp down on it. We're nearly back to where I was. There we go. YouTube. What I liked this morning when we had the Mentos and Diet Coke click, that's the first time I've seen that in high definition on a big screen. Because previously I've watched it in a 2-inch box on YouTube with occasional freezing and occasional jittering. It's not a good way to enjoy video. It's also limiting you in terms of when you're going to be able to enjoy that video. Whereas TV and DVD type devices, portable DVDs, don't. So increasingly, I'm looking at non-PC devices which are being connected into the IP network, connected into the internet, and are offering superior, in my opinion, experiences for a lot of these things, gaming, music, video communications, even web surfing, free phone calls, of course, than you would get on a PC. And I know some of you are saying, well, you know, ostensibly, you know, that pepper pad, top left-hand corner, is a PC. Yes, it is. So is, you know, this Nokia internet tablet down here. The important thing is they are not recognizable as PCs to the vast majority of consumers. You know, they're usually instant on or very quick boot up. They don't have Windows on them. None of these have Windows on them. The Xbox 360 obviously connects to Windows very well. And they are geared up typically to one or two key tasks, which could be social computing tasks, that they do extremely well. Anything you might not recognize there, the games consoles being a classic example of very powerful devices that are non-PC and increasingly are connected into the network. Microsoft will tell you that around 60% of Xbox 360 owners have connected their console online. That's comparing to about 5% with the previous generation of consoles. So these devices are also much cheaper and in some cases subsidized than a PC would be. And many of them travel with you. PSP will typically travel with you in your pocket if you're a keen gamer. This, of course, also completely misses out on the most popular non-PC device, which is mobile phones. And increasingly, mobile phones getting to the point where they can do a lot of this stuff as well as a PC, with all the additional benefits of convenience, timeliness, and choice. Must remember not to press that right-hand button again. Enough of the hypothesis. Let's look at some cool devices. And I've really split these up into devices which are A, portable, traveling with you all the time, and the ones that are looking at really, really drawing on that social computing power, and some mobile TV. Sony's Milo, My Life Online. Very reminiscent of the PSP device that you saw a couple of minutes ago, with good reason. I mean, that the PSP is web-connected, you can surf on it, you can download RSS feeds, but it doesn't have a keyboard, which means that it's pretty useless for any kind of texting, any kind of messaging. This device, which has only been out for less than a month in the market, is geared towards those tweens who want to be connected, want to be IMing, want to be chatting wherever they're in a Wi-Fi connected area. No mobile phone circuitry in here. Purely Wi-Fi, very visual, also geared up to music playing and photo storage, but really all about that text messaging using the keypad. It's a very social device, and again, it's a relatively low-cost device even compared to fairly standard PCs. Does rely on some infrastructure which isn't quite in place, like universal free Wi-Fi, but that's a minor stumbling block. I was being sarcastic. Yeah, it's a huge stumbling block. It's great if you live in any downtown urban American city. It's not so great if you live in any other country. You're absolutely true. It's the same problem with Zoom, is that you're looking at devices which are reliant on some infrastructure which has to be more or less universally available and very, very cheap before they can realize a lot of their potential. Some of the examples I'll come on to later on don't rely on that and are more here, but are also a bit more limited. Zoom, okay, so it's a music player from Microsoft. It's an iPod killer, of course, as various people describe it as. It plays music, you can load photos on it. That's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is the kind of sharing that's built into that. So I can share tracks with other people in my Wi-Fi vicinity. So again, you're looking for infrastructure to be provided for you. It's social expression. It's that all that great stuff you get from social computing, the fact that you are becoming part of a small group in your immediate area to share music. Is it going to kill the iPod? Probably not. But it's an interesting first attempt to try and introduce a more social element to music. And again, this is far, far more convenient than having to use a PC to download music, although you're going to have to load this up from a PC in the first place, typically. The games devices, again, rely on Wi-Fi. Interestingly, particularly with the Nintendo device, a lot of free Wi-Fi spots, like in McDonald's, where you can log in and play DS games across the globe. This is obviously the next level in terms of social engagement with people. You're not just sharing a track here and there. You're not just text messaging one of your friends. You could be playing Mario Karts with five other people anywhere in the world. PSP similarly has those Wi-Fi capabilities. You could also connect these devices when you're in a room via their own proprietary networking, which doesn't rely on any other infrastructure, but it's location specific. So again, it's sharing, it's convenience, it's devices that you carry with you that are connecting, reaching out to other people without any assistance from a PC. Phones, obviously, are the device that A, is owned by at least 75% of the population in most markets that I've looked at, skews to around about 90% in the kind of groups that are looking at social computing. So that 12 to 25-year-old, 35-year-old individual in developed markets. These are two devices which are relatively hot at the moment. The Helio, which is very geared towards sharing, very geared towards youth, launched in North America. And the LG Chocolate, which is LG's attempt to raise the bar up towards the kind of Razer phenomenon that Motorola's enjoyed for a while. Both good at music, both good at photos, both good at sharing, presence, instant messaging, all those good things, instant messaging, communicating textually with other people via phones. About 40% of North American consumers under a certain age use text messaging. That's typically, weight raises up to about 60 or 70% in many Western European markets. Doesn't rely on any infrastructure. Should work pretty much in any country, depending on roaming contracts. Always with you. Not the best thing to take photos with. Not the best keyboard to do long messages on. But that's not really the point. The issue here is the ease of sharing and the ease of communicating in some form, text speak, if you will. You also start to see that phone devices are starting to do those things which only PCs used to be able to do. Photo sharing and management. Nokia now has Flickr clients, or however you pronounce Flickr, built into their N series phones. This N series phone, which one is it? Is it the 90? It's the 93, has, I think, a 5 megapixel or an 8 megapixel camera in it. So allowing for decent optics, you can take pretty good pictures with this and upload them directly to your Flickr account, share them with your friends. You're also seeing that solutions, software-based solutions, which are offering to do this as well. Managing your photos, moving them between PCs, work PCs, phones. And it's just so much more convenient. This is something you can do when you've got 10 minutes downtime. You can think, oh, I'll pull together an album, which is our last holiday. You're not going to do that typically on the bus, on your laptop. Put it another way, most people aren't going to do that. We might do it, but we're pretty much an exception to the mass market. We're also starting to see video applications, particularly developing in Europe and the Asia Pacific market, which are all around sharing video phone to phone and online, as you can see here. Three, which is the Hutchinson Wampona 3G network in UK, Italy, a couple of other European markets, has got SeeMe TV uploading. You guess where the interface for this came from, can't you? Obviously, it's very, very, very similar to YouTube. Maybe 4 or 5 months ago, YouTube's continued to innovate. But you can link to clips, you can share clips, you can vote on clips, you can comment on clips. And again, there are services like this which are offering prizes for the best clip. This one has a £1,000 prize for the best clip that's uploaded. And you have stats in terms of votes. Like YouTube, it's the pratfalls that do very well. We've got Sled Collision, Watch My Fingers, the mind boggles, Woody Slap, literally knocking on heaven's door. Not going to challenge Scorsese anytime soon in terms of plot, but very entertaining for 15, 20 seconds, which is the kind of video you're wanting to watch on a mobile phone. And we're also seeing the emergence, again, from a number of European providers and in the US with things like VCast, of direct-to-mobile TV. A slight caveat with this one is that the business model is not entirely clear. Are you going to charge people for specific content? Are you going to bundle it into their subscription to stop them switching to another carrier? Are you going to use it like Sky does, which is basically to keep their satellite TV customers happy by providing extra services, ostensibly for free? But again, it's using a mobile phone in a way that typically you'd only been able to use a PC for on-demand content in the past. Then we start to get really funky. Cyworld is a South Korean application, which is a sort of a combined social network and avatar site. It's online and on your mobile, but the vast majority of customization and messaging is from people on the mobile platform. 9 out of 10 20-year-olds in South Korea are a member of this network, and like Kart Racer or some of the other games that you play online in South Korea, it's free to use, and you pay for customization. You pay for clothes, items, add-ons, ringtones, all the usual thing. And unlike a lot of these examples, which are fairly futuristic, they're making around $300,000 a day selling the virtual currency in this world. So it's already hugely profitable. Will it translate to the States or North America or Europe? Probably not to this level of engagement. It's a much more competitive marketplace. And you're seeing a lot of other services that do some of these things available for free. Sorry, virtual currency, Acorns. So basically you can charge up your virtual wallet with Acorns by buying via credit card or your mobile phone bill some currency. So, you know, it's like any of these virtual currencies. What they're doing basically is making sure that you're not spending 5 cents every 10 minutes, which they then have to have a transaction charge to a credit card on, basically. And same for the mobile billing. You don't want a 30-page long bill. Right. What you want is you say, on Thursday I bought $50 worth of Acorns, and then within the game, within the social network, you're spending that over that next month or so. Basically, the whole point of virtual currencies is either to get over some limitation in terms of credit card ownership or to get over some limitation in terms of transaction charges. Classically, you've seen, particularly in mobile, three things. You've either had reverse billing of SMS, premium SMSs. So, you know, you send me a message, I send you an SMS, and I bill you $5 for that. And that goes straight onto your mobile bill.
Right.
The other one is that you have, you have an agreement that you can, your mobile bill has a certain number of Acorns in every month, pre-billing effectively. When you run out, you could then go back to the SMS route. Or the least common and the most complex is to bill it to a credit card, because then obviously you are taking some risk on board and you're probably having a substantial transaction charge in there as well. We're also seeing very actively engaged gaming communities, which are again driving real revenue. On the Xbox, I'm Forrester's global gaming analyst, by the way, so that's why I know quite a lot about gaming. On the Xbox, you're seeing Xbox Live Marketplace delivering lots of retro titles, Space Invaders, Scramble, Pac-Man, which you download to your Xbox over the broadband network, and you pay in Microsoft points. It's another virtual currency, effectively, whereby you go into a retail store and you buy a pre-charged card for $10, $20, $50. Hugely successful. I forget the numbers now, but around 12 million things have been downloaded via Xbox Live Marketplace, and it's only been live for about 6 or 8 months. These are things which add into games you've already bought, or increasingly it is small retro games, something which Xbox 360 games are designed to be played for 3 or 4 hours at a go. The stuff you're downloading through Xbox Marketplace is things like Space Invaders, Pac-Man. You're playing it for 10 minutes or at a party. And I touched on this one before, Nintendo's Wi-Fi connection, which is how you take your Nintendo DS online. So this is where you are basically connecting into free hotspots in places like McDonald's or the cloud in the UK and challenging people to play across the global network. Both of these work significantly better because the endpoint is not a PC. You're getting around a lot of those issues of security. As you heard this morning, only a third of people transacting online actually trust the security that you're providing. You're abstracting that with a virtual currency, and you're also dealing with devices which are far more simple than a PC. They're not locked down. They're not as prone to hacking. For a normal consumer, it's very difficult to crack an Xbox or really get in underneath the skin of a Nintendo DS. And finally, you're also seeing some true social networks emerging on the mobile phone. Vcell, Vibes, is one which is, again, all about personalization, exactly like the sort of MySpace type proxy on your phone, usually advertised in fairly youth-centered magazines or TV, sometimes taking over from where the old wallpapers and ringtones market was, certainly in Europe, which is going away, and offering, obviously, ability to upload photos, create a profile, share that with your friends and colleagues, create lists, all that good stuff, geared to a phone, so it's not going to be pages and pages of blogs. It's going to be short statements, pictures, sound, music, and on a device that's with you all the time that you can take pictures with at any time and upload them directly to that network. The business model is typically here either advertising supported or you're paying a small subscription fee per month to get get these services. Another Microsoft example here, SLAM, is all about taking the pictures that you've got on your PC and sharing them with people who you have awareness with, presence information about on your phone. So obviously this would typically be a Microsoft-powered, Windows-powered phone, but similar things are being proposed by other people so that you, when certain people come online with their phone or say that they're available, you can track what they're doing, you can share things with them directly. Example from Singapore here, the Citizen Times has a column every day which is photos submitted via consumers on their phones. Citizen journalism, they call it. Stomp is the column. And it's you know, runs the gamut from mundane pictures of children in parks right the way up to valid news stories. But again, it's something which can't be done or is not going to be done by the mass market via a PC. So, in summary, we've seen a bunch of cool devices. The average number of units for each one of those devices in the market is tiny. The Nintendo DS, tens of millions, probably the most widespread of those devices apart from the phone. But a lot of those handsets that are very sophisticated also in a small minority. But what I would say is, despite the dominance of the PC, for these kind of social connecting applications, it may not be the best device. It's not always with you. Even if you've got a PC at home and a laptop and a PC at work, there are times, for most people, when they're not going to be able to use that PC. It's just inconvenient to get it out, to turn it on. It's too bulky. Even 12-inch laptops are too bulky to carry around with you all the time. And the battery life is likely to be only 3 or 4 hours. And coming back to the video example, it's a jack of all trades. PCs, even modern media center PCs, are not geared up to be great at video, great at sound, highly portable, great battery life. Typically, any one device that you look at might be good at one of those and poor at the rest, or kind of average at all of them. So portable devices, which increasingly have some form of connectivity. Wi-Fi is obviously a very easy one to add, but relies on that infrastructure being there in the first place. Mobile connectivity, whether it's 3G, EVDO, or slightly less sophisticated GSM technology, allows you to tap into that. The average cost of adding that kind of thing to a mass market device now, Ethernet, is probably, you know, only it's cents, 30 to 50 cents. Adding Wi-Fi to a device, maybe $1 to $3. Adding mobile functionality, slightly more expensive because you have to work out the bandwidths and the phone numbers. But it is doable for only a nominal cost of production, and you're opening up a whole world of potential revenues above and beyond what you have today. Ultimately, the mobile phone is the most obvious device to do this. Has a lot of the photo taking and storage capabilities already. It's with people all the time. It's pre-connected to a network by definition, at least one. Some of them are now connected to mobile networks, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, infrared, and any other things. You know, you start to see WiMAX added to that soon as well, and DVB-H TV broadcasting. Plus, these things are replaced every 2 years. How often do people replace their TVs? About every decade. PCs, we'd like to say 2 years. Typically, we're seeing 3 to 4 years. These things are replaced every 2 years. Anything that's a major innovation in phones, you can pretty much guarantee that in 4 years from now, if everybody adopts that, the vast majority of consumers will have that in their handset. I don't know what the European, the North American figure is, but about 25% of all handsets in Europe already have camera functionality, just because all the other phones have been thrown out. Even the prepaid phones have this kind of functionality. So the phone is the obvious way for this to go. It's also uniquely tied to you, so you can customize it to an infinite degree. It has built-in presence, and it has built-in textual communication. So that was my summary. Thanks very much for your time. I hope this has at least got you thinking.